Welcome, everybody, to the next in this series of webinars and Q&As. This is Using Rainmaker to Build Authority and Community Through Podcasting, the Q&A following the webinar we had last week. Thank you for being here. I am Robert Bruce, and I'm joined by Jared Morris, John Naster, Brian Hayes, and Amelia Briscoe. We've got a great crew for this Q&A, and thank you. You dropped a bunch of great questions that we're going to be going through. And again, I'll repeat what I said a moment ago. We're going to go about an hour. And if you've got other questions, please feel free to drop them in the chat. If anything goes wrong here, we'll do the replay. We'll send out an email for where you can find the replay of this Q&A within a few days-ish. So, but you will see that. So thank you for showing up here. And Jared, John, Brian, and Amelia, thank you for being here. How about we get this thing going?
Let's do it.
All right. So I think we just went straight into questions. Yeah. Question number one, are there any demographics available on people who listen to podcasts? I'm starting up a new digital commerce initiative on Rainmaker, and my target demographic is professional people, people with sound experience in business, people over 45. Is podcasting a good tool for reaching this demographic?
This is a great question. And Johnny, I know that you have some stats from your show in particular that are going to be really helpful. You know, it's important, you know, when we talk about demographics and stats, one of the biggest frustrations that people have with podcasting is a lack of reliable data a lot of times. So, you know, we do kind of struggle with that. But if you're looking at demographics and stats on podcasting, one place that is always good to go is the Edison Research Infinite Dial study that they put out every year. And we have a link that we're going to drop here into the chat that you can look at that has the updated 2017 numbers. And I pulled a couple of them out because I think they're interesting, you know, just to kind of give you an overview, you know, in terms of what some of these demographic numbers are. So, you know, you're looking for people, you know, professional people, people with sound experience in business, people over the age of 45. And so just to give you a couple of numbers here that you might find interesting, one of the stats that they track is smartphone ownership. And obviously, you know, people are much more likely to listen to a podcast if they have a smartphone. And it won't surprise you to know that those numbers are darn near reaching 100%, as, you know, people between the age of 25 and 54 are at 89% smartphone ownership. 12 to 24 is at 95%. And they actually break out the other group for people 55 and older in there as well. And it's a little bit lower, but it's still growing as well. Now, the numbers that you will find interesting is that monthly online radio listening for the age group from 25 to 54 is at 70%. So 70% of the people that they talk to have listened to online radio in the past month from when they talked to them. That is up 5%. And obviously, and the numbers for online radio listening, which is typically music, those are always higher than podcasts, but it's a good indicator if someone has listened to music online that, you know, they kind of know what they're doing. They can use Spotify. They're comfortable doing that, and they're going to be more likely to listen to podcasts. And so those numbers are all rising for monthly and weekly online radio listening. Specific to podcasts, the age group from 25 to 54 is actually the highest growing. So 31% of folks 25 to 54 have listened to a podcast in the past month. That is up 7%. From the 2016 study, the age group of 12 to 24 is at 27%. That was actually flat, which I found surprising. And then the age group of 55 plus is at 12% have listened to a podcast in the past month. That's up 1%. Now, I know those numbers are a little bit low, but you got to remember that, you know, even if it's 31% of, you know, all the people in the United States, that's still a huge number of people. And when you look at the number of people who A, own smartphones, and who B, are already comfortable listening to online radio monthly, where again, that number was 70%, you can see the huge opportunity. So I think podcasts will continue to grow. And there's already enough people that are listening, even in your demographic, that if you have the right fit of content and audience, that I definitely think the stats show that podcasting can work for you. Just the overall demographics. Now, Johnny, I know you have some numbers from Hack the Entrepreneur that may be even more specifically applicable to the situation of this questioner.
Yeah. So I have some, we run like, I guess, manual surveys where we get people to go to a landing page and fill out the survey to get this data, because as Jared said, this data isn't really readily available to us. So my numbers are small, as in the sample size. I have 423 responses from the last, we did it, I think it was about 7 or 8 months ago was the last one we did. And so it is a business podcast, though, so it does cover the demographic you're looking for. So I hope that it should provide you some insight. So from 423 responses, for you looking at the 45 and over, from 45 to 54 is 10% of my audience. 55 to 64 is 12% of my audience. And 65 plus covers 1% of the audience. And these are obviously professional and business people. I do, it does skew. I don't know if gender plays into it for you. So I have male at 41% and female at 30%. And then another 11% either transgender or non-conforming, and 7 people not responding. For job titles, if this helps you at all, I'll share this information as well. So 7% of the 423, 7% of them are C-level. President or vice president is 9%, a director and management are 24%, and then it goes down to coordinator consultant at about 28% combined, and then fills into other. So I'm not sure what other information I have here, but I think that I think, like as Jared was saying, it's like the numbers seem small where the age group you're looking for seems like perhaps a small percent, where it's what makes up about 23% of my audience. But with podcasting, it's that very super targeted. So you don't necessarily need huge numbers, and you don't, it's almost unnecessary for it to be 100%, because those 23% that you are targeting are the exact right person for you. And so we can sort of use those numbers and I guess glean more insight into it. But so those are mine from Hack the Entrepreneur, and that's 423 people. So
yeah, and I think it's important, you know, the question is podcasting a good tool for reaching this demographic? It certainly can be, but it also is going to depend on your goals. So is podcasting a good tool for reaching this demographic and making hundreds of thousands of dollars on ad revenue? Perhaps not, because you may not be able to get the overall numbers, but the numbers are still there, even if, you know, a little bit smaller than what it may be if you were targeting a younger demographic. The numbers are certainly still there to, you know, create that connection and to, you know, achieve goals. If you're, you know, you said a digital commerce initiative. So if you're trying to get people into an online course or something of that nature, you know, to where you don't need huge, huge numbers to be successful, then the answer for that is yes. So you just want to make sure that your goals are realistic. And if they are, then I certainly think that podcasting can be a good tool for reaching the demographic you're trying to reach.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point, because looking holistically at this question, not just, you know, is this target demographic that I've determined worth it, but what are the overall big goals of the business? And do you need to have, not everybody needs to have, you know, a revenue generating through advertising massive podcast, which is a lot of what we talk about, obviously. But anyway, that's a great point, Jared. All right, should we move on to question number two?
Yeah, let's.
And before I do this, before we get into this question, I should say it was interesting. The questions that came through, you'll see here, are largely about podcasting alone, not necessarily the technical aspects of podcasting with Rainmaker, just so everyone's aware. So we're going with what you sent in. And, you know, in this case, it's good because this is exactly the stuff that we like talking about, nerding out about. So question number two, what guidance can you give for planning the length and frequency of a podcast? So we hear a lot of talk about, oh, a podcast should be 5 minutes. A podcast should be 20 minutes. No, a podcast should be 2.5 hours, you know, long form content. What kind of things do you, Jared and Johnny, think about when you're, well, this would be interesting. Johnny, what did you think about this question when you started Hack the Entrepreneur? and has your opinion or strategy on, you know, the length and frequency of your show changed in the number of years that you've been doing it?
Ooh, good question. Yes, I absolutely thought about this 100%, and I rigidly stuck to it for the first, I'm going to say, 100 episodes. So my goal was to come in under 30 minutes with every single episode, because I was targeting professionals and people who worked and therefore probably commuted into an office of some sort. And the average commute in North America is like 28 minutes or something.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's like that whole listener journey, right? Like, I want to take my listener every single episode and sort of give them something. I don't want them to be sitting in the parking lot and there's 12 minutes left in the episode and they got to run in because it's time to go to work. And they're like, they don't get that sort of satisfaction from me. And so I wanted that sort of moment every time. And then they get to run into work and like think about me all day. Hopefully that's my goal.
Yeah.
In whatever ways they want to. and so as my show's grown, as my audience has sort of changed, I mean, it's crazy to say, but in 3 years, the way people work has changed. Not everybody commutes anymore. It's actually greater and greater amounts of people don't. They work from co-working spots and coffee shops everywhere, right? So I've allowed it to kind of go when it needs to into deeper spaces to say 40, 45 minutes an episode if we're getting somewhere good. And so my, I guess the way I think about it now is that there isn't sort of a set number because every sort of topic, every show is going to need something different, but it needs to, as terrible as this sounds because it doesn't really give you a guidance, but it really needs to be as long as it needs to be, but absolutely no longer. Like you need to know when stop before your listener. There's nothing worse than you're listening to a show and it's really, really good. And then all of a sudden there's 10 minutes pass and you weren't paying attention because it was just, and also you're not focused anymore and you're not sort of getting that satisfaction out of it. You need to know in advance when the conversation or the show is going that way and be able to pull it back before that happens so that you always keep your listener sort of engaged.
Okay. Yep. So one quick question before I ask Jared the same question about assembly call, because it's going to be very different. I expect, but when you did, so you did this really serious kind of thought process about who you're talking to, which goes back to question number one, and how you want to talk and how they live and the commute and the 30 minute commute, all of that. One side question, when you do those 45 minute episodes, when they do happen organically and naturally, because it's a great conversation, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but just anecdotally, do you have a sense of those longer episodes do well, even though you know that your target kind of hit for your people is that 30 minute sweet spot?
Yeah. So absolutely, anecdotally, obviously. And I always get emails from people that they love when it goes a bit longer because we dove into, they're like, I love how you followed that sort of that part of the conversation down. But then if I go and look at like, and start reading through like the 400 reviews on iTunes, 90% of them are just like, I love how he doesn't have like 10 minute intros. He doesn't have, everything's just to the point. He doesn't waste my time. So
yeah.
It's like, can I please everyone? I really feel like I have the space now. I've made the space in my show that when the conversation is going somewhere that is absolutely of value, and I know the listener's sitting there like, I wish you would ask this. And then I ask that question and we go that place and we allow it. People like it. But then if it doesn't happen in the next conversation, I don't push it so that, well, everybody said they like 45 minute episodes. So now let's turn this conversation into 10 minutes of banter. You know what I mean? It really, you really have to just really always be aware of it. And really when it starts to wane, you have to pull it back and cut it off and move on to the next thing. And people would rather get 10 minutes of absolute brilliance than 10 minutes of brilliance and 30 extra minutes of just nonchalance. It's not what people want, right? They'll move on. So you have to,
they could have been listening to another podcast in that time. That's why your emphasis on respecting your audience's time is so great.
Exactly. But if you're doing hardcore history, I mean, you can't do that in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Which it's great. Just the way it works.
Segue into the same question for Jared. Did you get for your one of your shows, Assembly Call, totally different format, totally different audience from John's Hack the Entrepreneur. And it's a completely different approach. But what can you say, or can you speak to anything in regards to this question, Jared, in the context of Assembly Call, in terms of how you maybe did or did not think about putting that show together, length, frequency, all of that?
Yeah, we definitely thought about it. I mean, typical post-game shows for a sporting event, you know, when you listen to them on the radio, they go for about an hour. And we never necessarily said, like, we are going to go for an hour, but that always just seemed to be the sweet spot. We were always ending it 55 minutes or 65 minutes, 60 minutes, somewhere in there, because that always seemed to be the amount of time that we needed to talk about all the different elements of the game. And so that just ended up being the sweet spot. And that's what we went with. You know, and I've hosted shows of all different lengths. You know, I did a daily podcast for a while that was about 8 to 10 minutes. And the Sites podcast right now, I try and keep those to 15 to 20 minutes. I do another IU basketball podcast. We try and keep that to 20 to 25 minutes. So, you know, Johnny, what you said about it needs to be as long as it needs to be and no longer, you know, I know that seems like really general advice, but that is really the best guidance about length. You know, Sam Harris does these 2-3 hour long conversations, but when you're delving into, you know, talking about consciousness and some of these really detailed discussions with really smart people, sometimes you want to have that space for them to really go into it. And if the content is good enough, the audience will stick with it. And so, you know, that's kind of it's a dance that you do with your audience. And, you know, maybe you can figure it out ahead of time, you know, like Johnny was able to, and maybe you need to do some trial and error. But that's kind of what you go through. Now, what I think is interesting is frequency, because, you know, I really think most shows should try to show up once a week in your audience's feed, unless you have a reason to do otherwise. Because, you know, if you show up once a week, you stay top of mind, you know, people don't forget about you. But, you know, going more than once a week can be a little bit difficult for people to keep up with. Now, Johnny obviously does a show where he goes, you know, 2-3 times a week with Hack the Entrepreneur. And you can do that if, you know, obviously your show is good enough and you have a dedicated enough audience. For us with the Assembly Call, you know, during the season, we're in our audience's feeds 3 or 4 times a week, because we have our weekly show plus post game shows. And then during the off season, it's back to once, you know, just once a week. And so the frequency changes based on the needs of the audience. And so, you know, you can have some of those considerations as well. But I think trying to appear at least once a week is, that's kind of a good rule of thumb. You know, I can't say, I don't really believe in rules of thumb for length. Like, you should always keep it at 20 minutes, because it really depends. But I think a good rule of thumb for frequency is once a week. And then if you want to deviate from that, you should really have a reason for doing so. Because I just, again, it keeps you top of mind. And that tends to be a standard that I think works pretty well.
I will, as a side note, I heard Adam Carolla say once, if you're not doing it every day, don't do it. Which is pretty brutal, but goes to kind of that professional broadcasting mode. Obviously, with people with running businesses, that'd be tough to impossible. But yeah, frequency, once you set that frequency, to Jared's point, all important, being consistent in that. Okay, before we go on another hour on this one question, as we alluded to in the beginning.
We should have budgeted 17 hours for this Q&A.
We really should have. It could have been the longest Q&A ever. Maybe the next one. Yeah, let's do question number 3, which is, before starting a podcast station, I'm assuming one would record at least a few episodes, shows to have ready ahead of time. Is it best to upload a few all at once, or is it better to just start with one and let the rest drip out? I think, Jared and Johnny, you addressed this multiple times, but specifically in one episode of The Showrunner, at least. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. We get this question a lot, and this is actually part of the launch plan inside of the Showrunner podcasting course, which I should mention is going to be open from September 20th to September 27th. So if you go to showrunner.fm and get on our email list, we'll let you know when it's open. But this is part of the launch plan. And Johnny, this is actually something that I learned from you, which is the benefit of having some episodes done and ready to go when you launch. You know, having 4 or 5 episodes in the can and published so that when you get into iTunes and when you start promoting your iTunes link and getting people to listen, you know, they listen to that first episode, they like it and they want more. But if there's nothing there, you lose that moment of impulse and the benefit that you can get from that and the binge that often happens. People find a new show that they really like. So having those three or four episodes there so that it shows people that this isn't a show that's just, you know, one episode and going to go away. It gives them that ability to binge listen. And it gives you that benefit of, you know, getting those downloads and having another enticement for a subscription. I think for all of those reasons and many, many more, it's good to have some shows in the bank and to actually have those shows in your feed published, ready to go before you even start promoting your iTunes link. Are there any other reasons, Johnny, why you think it's a smart thing to do?
Well, because I think that life happens and we get sick or something happens and we have all the good intentions. We launch the show and then 2 weeks into it, something completely, like you get allergies like I did this week and you can't record. And now you're in week three and you're not publishing. Like it's the worst precedent to set for building an audience. So the general rule of thumb that we sort of push in the showrunner course is that you have to go back to question two. You have to decide how often you want to publish, as Jared says, minimum one per week, which I absolutely agree with. And then you want to have 1 month's worth of shows in the can, 100% complete when you launch, as well as on the day you launch, you want to have three episodes released. So that, as Jared said, when somebody finds your show, there's something to subscribe to, so it downloads all three shows. If there's only one show, there's nothing really to subscribe to. There's just, you just press play and then they forget about you. So start with three shows, decide on your frequency. If it is once per week, then you need, for a month, you need four extra shows, which means you need seven shows before you launch, and then kind of try and stay ahead of it from there. To me, that's the simplest way to follow it and to be successful coming out of the gate.
Yep. All right, question four. What are your thoughts on including podcast chapters in the audio files? This is a very interesting question to me because along with the rise of audio books, which are so convenient in their use of chapters, when they're done right, I will say. There's many that are not done right and it becomes a huge hassle, but this might go back to, I think it was question two about length of the episode, but what do you guys think in terms of breaking things up? And this, I question, would also include the idea of really significant show notes, which, you know, break out timestamps for certain parts of the discussion.
What do you think about this one, Johnny? Because, I mean, like my thoughts on this are that I haven't really thought about it. Like I haven't really, I mean, I obviously, you know, have seen podcast chapters in audiobooks, but I have never, as a podcast listener, found myself wanting podcast chapters in the audio files. And for that reason, I've never, as a showrunner, thought about doing it for the audience. I mean, I can see with some longer and really stringently organized shows, right, or episodes, how this would work, but I haven't really thought about it being worth the time and effort for the shows that I have produced. Have you, Johnny?
So I have slightly thought about it, but then immediately discarded it because I'm a show that is 100% funded by sponsors. And to me, you're going to be skipping sponsor ads.
That's a good point.
And
good
call. Therefore, I've lost my revenue.
Yep.
Yep.
That's a great consideration.
Yeah, it's like when we could start recording TV shows, right, and skip over the ads. It changed everything. And so it seems like that's what finances most of podcasting. So is sponsorships at this point. And so we need to kind of keep that in place. There's already 15-second skips and 30-second skips on apps. So
right,
beyond
right,
that, I think we're just enabling it.
Yeah.
I will say there are two podcasts that I listen to that do actually do multiple shows per week. But one of, both of them actually do this, like the whatever, let's just say the Friday show is a Q&A. And so in both of those cases, they don't do chapters, you know, skippable chapters within the audio, but they do timestamp broken out by question in the show notes. And I have several times, you know, I'll skip, like you said, Johnny, I'll go 15, 15, 15, 15 to the question that I want to listen to. But I will say in that format, which is, you know, relatively rare. And Jared, like you said, it's only going to apply to certain kinds of shows, which this format it would. I would say in that format, I would love to have that skip to this chapter, question number four, which is an hour and 45 minutes in. But most people are not going to have to worry about that. And I think in the context of what we're talking about, you guys are right. It would actually probably do, you could argue, a little more harm than good.
Right. And to go back, like, to Jared, as you said, Sam Harris, like 2.5 hour, like, brilliant conversations. If there was like questions that he's asking his guest and you could like skip ahead 2 hours to that, that might be kind of intriguing to me. Because sometimes those conversations, as much as I love them when I listen to them, they're daunting to get into. Like, my dog can only walk for so long. It's serious, man. It's a serious endeavor, right? So, or like the hardcore histories, right? If you could sort of jump to parts, that's pretty cool. But again, I'm going back to a show. I come from a show that tries to be 30 minutes long. I mean, there's only so much in there to kind of skip around to anyways. So,
you know, the other thing to think about too, with a show like Hardcore History, or even Sam Harris's conversations, is, you know, those conversations really build on each other. And a lot of times a question they're asking 2 hours in, you know, they're referencing what they talked about an hour before. Hardcore History, you know, you really need to have listened for the first hour to understand the context of the third hour. So I wonder if those two as hosts would even want to do that, because the audience would have lost, you know, skipping ahead, they would lose some of the context that they got from the earlier conversation. So that's something to think about if you're thinking about chapters. You know, if it's very specific questions, Robert, like you said, that are kind of unrelated, I could see it. But you want to be careful that you're not inviting people to skip ahead to where they think, oh, well, the host is inviting me to skip ahead, so this must be okay. But if understanding the context from the earlier sections is important to what they're skipping ahead to, you don't want to degrade the experience just because you think you're giving some convenience.
Yeah, I'd buy that. Yep. Let's do number five.
Let's do it.
I'm told that the platform is not a long-term hosting solution. The Rainmaker platform is not a long-term hosting solution for a podcast, and eventually a different host is needed. Is that true? And if so, are there instructions on how to switch your hosting of audio files to a service like Libsyn? So this, I don't know who had given this information or who had told this questioner that. This might be a good moment to bring Amelia and Brian in terms of, you know, we've talked about what the limits of what are the storage and bandwidth limits of the platform in terms of podcasts, and especially when you get into podcast network. Brian, Amelia, do you want to speak to that at all? If microphones are working.
Hello. You can pretty much upload the audio files into Rainmaker. There is it does come with a default storage space for you to use. But if you want to use a third-party service such as Audello or Libsyn, all you need is the actual file URL that you've uploaded to that service, and then you add it into the podcast player settings. So you can still use that service but have the episode play from the Rainmaker podcast area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is, I mean, the platform is built for podcast hosting. That is certainly absolutely one of the considerations that went into the building of the platform itself. But Jared, what is your idea here in terms of hosting the podcast on the platform and your experience with it? I mean, obviously this is going to be, you know, take this with a grain of salt because, you know, Jared and I are both employed by Rainmaker Digital. But just in terms of what it means to host a podcast on the platform.
Well, the platform is definitely a long-term solution for hosting a podcast. I mean, there's no question. I mean, I have the assembly call on there. We're getting ready to do our 336th episode tonight, I think. And they're all, you know, on there and accessible. And so it is definitely a long-term solution. Now, where it says eventually a different host is needed, is that true? The answer is no. A different host is not going to be needed. Rainmaker is a long-term solution. Now, could a different host be desired? Possibly. You know, as you grow with your show, you may have very, very specific niche needs that would, you know, where you might benefit by looking elsewhere. Like, for instance, you know, someplace like Spreaker, when we started doing a weekly radio show for the Assembly Call, I signed up for the Spreaker service, not because I wanted to host my podcast there, but because the little recorder player that they give me actually allowed me to record our episode in four different segments with intro and outro music, and then get the segments all ready to go, didn't require any post-production, so I could upload them so the radio stations who play our show could download them. Now, that is a very, very specific niche need, which is the reason why I signed up for Spreaker. But I don't need to use Spreaker to host the podcast. The Rainmaker still does everything that I need from a host perspective, but some of those additional bells and whistles that as a showrunner you may want to bring a better experience to your audience, you could eventually, you know, find yourself at a point where you'd like to have those, or you know, your show needs those. So I think, you know, and those are two different things. You know, that doesn't necessitate a new host, but it may be a bell and whistle that you want to add. So I think for, and again, you know, that show's been around now for 7 years, and most people aren't producing a podcast that they also need to run on the radio, which just provides a different kind of production process for us now. So I think for most people using Rainmaker, and certainly for most of the people that we talk to on the Showrunner, Rainmaker gives you literally everything that you would need to run a podcast. So that's what I would say to that.
Let's keep moving here. I think we're on track. We got six questions left. We're just over a half an hour in. So I think we can do it, and then add, hopefully we can have room for a couple more questions that were dropped this morning. Number six, how did you get that pod player? Mine looks totally different when I add the audio file. So this is in reference, Jared, to the demo we did last week regarding Rainmaker.fm. And I think you specifically were on the screen with, well, several different shows, but Showrunner in particular. And that is, I mean, I'll just add, that is, as we discussed, have discussed before, that's custom design. I mean, the player itself is available to everyone, but the page, as you saw, it is custom designed by Rafal Tamal, who's our lead designer at Rainmaker Digital. But the podcast player itself is, you know, part of the package, so to speak, for every Rainmaker customer.
Yeah. I think that's a good answer. And what we showed with how you can embed the player, you know, put it on different pages, right, put it on other sites, that is all part of the standard player. So right, you know, you can certainly have, you know, something custom done to get that special player like Rafal designed. But I mean, I've always really liked the standard Rainmaker player. It's simple. It's elegant. It pulls in your featured image. It has the title of the episode right there. It's got the sharing buttons. It's got the player embed code. So it's really, it's got everything that you would want in an episode player.
All right, let's jump to question seven. Is, I'd love if you could talk some more about the financial ROI of podcasting versus time and energy. I was a bit surprised at how long you said last week you're spending on average producing each podcast episode. And I was looking back at this, Jared and Johnny, I'm not exactly sure, maybe one of you are, what this person is referring to in terms of that
maybe discussion. Maybe referencing an actual episode of the Showrunner. I think we talked about this in an episode of the Showrunner.
It took 15 hours for me to produce half hour last week.
Yeah, I can't remember if that was on the webinar or if it was on...
It was. That was on the webinar.
Maybe it was on the webinar.
Yeah.
So how about... let's just talk about that. That sounds insane to the normal person out in the world and even to me. But what does that actually look like, Johnny? And really, this is actually a really interesting question too, in terms of time and energy and maybe implied... the psychology of that kind of work, right? Like getting these shows done.
Right. So these hours I talked about, these 15 hours in production are, I guess I would say, indirect and direct sort of hours. And the way we talk about like revenue or like making money or financial ROI with the Showrunner is indirect. So by indirect and direct, time usage or time consumption, I guess, for me to create this is literally from the beginning of probably interaction with a potential guest via email, to booking them, to researching them, to recording, to then sending it off to be produced by the editor, then to creating show notes, and then to publishing and marketing it. So it doesn't take me necessarily 15 hours to record a 30-minute episode, as in 15 hours of me behind a microphone and we edit it heavily like a Metallica record. It's just literally the whole thing. Like, none of it exists without the rest of it. I couldn't get the same guests I get if I didn't spend that time up front. I couldn't do the same interviews if I didn't spend that same time researching. And the show wouldn't reach the same audience if I didn't spend that same time afterwards. So that's literally what I mean. And that's not all me by all means. But those are sort of like people hours that are spent on an episode, right, of which I put out 2 per week. So that's the clarification of the indirect and sort of direct hours. People like Gimlet or NPR, like they spend what, 30 hours on a half hour piece of content or something, but that's literally them behind microphones putting together stories. That's completely different than what I'm doing. And obviously those things sort of start off where they don't take as much time. And if you're not doing it full time like I am, and it's not maybe as important that it takes that much time, because you don't need to reach as many people. You don't need to deal with the sponsors for the episodes, all those things. And you don't need to get copy like verified and everything. So all those things do take time, but it's not necessarily the same amount of time that it took me when I started, when it was just sort of a side thing that I did, rather than a full-time thing.
Yeah, I'll add to that, like with the Sites podcast that I'm doing, you know, where I'm basically taking old content from Copyblogger, really popular content, and turning it into podcast episodes. You know, that, you know, I do all that production myself, you know, for the most part, other than, you know, the, you know, getting the featured image ready and getting the blog post ready, that kind of thing, you know, but that takes about an hour to get the script ready, about a half hour to 45 minutes to actually, you know, record the different segments and then put them up into the template, which is already ready made. So it's, you know, 2.5 hours, you know, to get those episodes in. And that's obviously a simpler show production wise than what Johnny is putting together. But there are a lot of different ways, obviously, you know, to format your show and to structure your show, especially if it's a big, if limiting the amount of time and energy is a concern. There are ways to do that, you know, to get in and out of the production element quicker than what we described.
And there's a couple follow-up questions in the chat that I'll ask here, but I wanted to ask first briefly if, without revealing, you know, actual numbers, Johnny, can you speak to the financial ROI of podcasting as this person is asking at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Podcasting now completely, is my like main source of income. And that's running 2 episodes per week of Hack the Entrepreneur. And that's, again, there's indirect and there's direct sort of monetization through that. But the biggest portion of it is direct, which is sponsorships from companies. And then there's indirect, which is all kinds of things like creating courses, doing coaching and consulting, any number of things around it that can be called indirect, just from the audience and the, just, you know, what you build as a person becoming an expert in your marketplace. But absolutely the direct financial ROI for me. And so again, this is totally just my example. It's not how it maybe normally works, but I mean, I launched 3 years ago, but it was like September 5th. And by the third week of October, I had 3 companies reach out to sponsor me. I took one of the companies, and they paid me in advance for 4 months, I believe it was at the time, or 3 months, something like that. And then they continued to sponsor me for 3 years, still to this day. And so that was when I got to kind of change it and hire people to start helping me. Then I started putting out more episodes, and it kind of just went from there. And that's not obviously the way it works for everybody necessarily. I happened to hit a market in the right way at the right time. And I got lucky in that way, but it's absolutely 100% viable as an ROI. but you kind of do need to go into it. As we alluded to earlier and spoke on, I believe in question one or two, was you need to sort of know what the goals are of the show when you're starting. Like, what is it? Like, is it to drive business to an existing company already, or things you want to sell? Or is it to build an audience and then build sort of a podcasting company around it where you sell ads and can create all this other forms of ad revenue? You kind of need to know that when you start talking about ROI and how quickly you can kind of determine it. If it's just to literally drive traffic, well-targeted traffic to an existing company, it's way, way, way faster than it is to actually build an audience from scratch and then monetize that audience.
Yeah.
And Jared, before we move to question eight, Bridget in the chat is asking, could you do even, you know, this is going to be estimated depending on the type of show you do and the format and all of that. But, you know, she's asking how many hours of research, how many hours booking, how many hours promoting? Is there like a basic kind of breakdown that you could do? This, again, it's a tough question because it's going to be different with every different kind of show. But let's just say. Well, I guess it would have to be if we're talking booking an interview show. Let's just say for the showrunner, you guys don't do interviews as much as Johnny does on Hack the Entrepreneur. But yeah, could you give a basic breakdown, like an example breakdown?
The showrunner is interesting because, you know, when you talk about hours spent researching, I mean, you know, all the time that I spend producing the assembly call in a lot of ways is researching for the showrunner, you know. So, you know, for something like that, where it's, you know, where you're really lending your knowledge and your experience that you've gained, so much of what you're doing can be research, you know. And so a lot of times, you know, when it comes to preparation for an episode, you know, John and I will put an outline together, but we don't necessarily have to get that detailed with the outline because we're talking about something that we live and breathe, you know. And if you're doing that, if you're, you know, if you're kind of the talent, so to speak, and you're giving your own expertise about something like that, it's kind of hard to quantify the actual, you know, hours of research. You know, it's kind of different for each, you know, for each show, to a certain extent. But I don't know, Johnny, what you think about this, but, you know, I'm kind of thinking, I mean, in terms of a rule of thumb, you know, for a lot of shows, you know, I think in many ways you can almost follow kind of a one-to-one-to-one relationship, you know, when it comes to, you know, how many hours research, you know, to actually, you know, recording the show and then to promoting it. You know, if it takes about a half hour to produce, you know, to record a show, it seems reasonable to spend, you know, at least a half hour preparing for it, if you can prepare in that amount of time, and then about a half hour promoting it, you know, putting it out on social media, you know, emailing it to people, you know, maybe emailing your list, that kind of thing. That seems to me like it would be kind of a reasonable rule of thumb, then with all kinds of wiggle room in there, just depending on the specifics of your show and what you really need to do to produce something good.
That seems fair. That seems fair. And that, I mean, it doesn't include like the editing process and production necessarily. But because that can vary so much. But I mean, that can also be outsourced. And like, we're spoiled, right, with the showrunner in that way. Most of it gets sort of not done by us. We get to show up and just talk about podcasting and share what we've learned throughout the week on our shows. And then the rest gets kind of taken care of for us, which is absolutely a blessing. But it's hard to compare it to anybody else's show.
And let me add this. This is why it's so important to, as much as you can, try to standardize what you're doing and simplify your template, because there are so many things that you could do with your show. You know, I remember when you're first doing the lead, you know, and I was editing that myself, you know, I would always try and pull out like a cool clip from the beginning as kind of a cold open, you know, something kind of taken out of context that was funny or, you know, just kind of attention grabbing, put that at the beginning, you know, and then I would try and take out every to just make it the most pristine sounding show. But it was literally taking me 2 or 3 hours an episode to do that. And I realized, you know, I don't really think we're getting the return on this investment of time. I don't think it improves the listening experience that much. And so even though, you know, I liked having that little cold open in there, you know, we ended up taking it out because it was like, you know, there's other things that we can do. And we ended up having to simplify the template. So you really have to measure these, you know, grand ideas that you may have. And, oh, this sounded cool on this show, I want to add it to my show. Well, it may be a great thing to add, but is it worth it? Because it's going to cost you time. And if it's in your template, you have to do it every single episode. So make sure that it's really worth it to do that. And so that's not to say make sure everything is in one take and that you can just, you know, plug it in there. There may be some things that you want to do with it, but just be very intentional, especially from the beginning, that you understand what kind of time investment it's going to be and that you want to commit to doing that long term.
That is great advice for all the reasons you just laid out. But also, Jared and Johnny, as you know, there is a very real danger of overproducing that really, really knocks down the quality of a show. I mean, we as humans, we want, I mean, some of us anyway, want things to be perfect, but that's not what humans are and not how we talk to each other normally. And you can really tell in an overproduced situation, it just doesn't sound right. It doesn't feel right.
I don't like shows that take out the ums and the ahs and that, that change the normal flow of the conversation. I always find it sounds wrong to my ear and I just don't enjoy listening to them.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
To me, that was a huge part actually of getting, being able to hire an editor, because when I did my first like 30 episodes myself, I was doing that too. But as soon as you give it to someone else, they don't notice it because they're not as neurotic as we are about ourselves. and the show gets so much better because it just opens it up and is more natural. To me, that's a huge like side benefit of sort of outsourcing the production process.
Yep.
So number eight, we got about 10 minutes left here. How much traffic can you directly contribute to the podcast? And again, in context, specifically here, I think we were talking about the showrunner at that point, but to the showrunner membership site. But generally, I think maybe it's more interesting to open this up generally to the idea of, you know, what does a podcast do for a product or a whatever the goal may be, whether that's a product or an email opt-in or a, you know, membership site sign up or registration. You know what, and this is going to be, you know, mostly anecdotal within asking, you know, both of you this question, but what kind of results generally do you see using a podcast to drive people to a desired action?
Yeah, it's interesting the way that this question is worded. You know, how much traffic can you directly contribute to the podcast? You know, and when I first read it, I thought it was how much traffic can you directly attribute to the podcast? And I would say either way, I don't know that thinking about it in terms of traffic is the right way to think about it. Whether it's, you know, how many people are coming from the podcast to my website or how much traffic is my podcast getting, I would not think about it in terms of traffic, because ultimately traffic really doesn't matter. Again, unless you have numbers that are so big that you're able to, you know, just monetize your numbers. And you know, Johnny has this on Hack the Entrepreneur. He has big numbers, but I know, Johnny, even you, you know, think about more, okay, it's not just the numbers, but what are people actually doing? So when I provide a call to action, you know, maybe it's to go to my email list or to go to this particular landing page, how many people are taking me up on that? And so maybe you look at, you know, just the traffic numbers on a specific landing page that you have set up, you know, from your podcast. But even more than that, the traffic that gets to the page doesn't matter. It's how many people actually convert. And so that's what I always like to think about, is not necessarily the numbers, not the traffic going to my site or the download numbers for my show, but, you know, if I have a show that we're driving donations like the assembly call, how many people are actually donating? You know, how many people are actually getting on to my email list? Because I know that that people are much more likely to donate when they're on the email list. So how many people are actually subscribing? How many people actually subscribed in the 24 hours after this podcast went out? Those are the kinds of things that I would look at. Because if you're using a podcast in the right way and using it to develop that really deep, rich connection, then people are going to take you up on your calls to action. And so that's what I would look at, because if people aren't taking you up on calls to action, there's a disconnect there somewhere. And I don't think you're maximizing what a podcast can do.
All right, let's move it on to number nine. What are the best viable ways to monetize a podcast? Sponsor, advertising, but what else? And how many listener subscribers would a sponsor be likely to want in order to be interested in sponsoring your show?
Johnny, I think you're best at answering.
Big old question. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And so this ties back to, I think, the first question when we were talking demographics. Demographics of highly targeted shows and highly targeted people. needs to be at the forefront sort of this conversation and of your mindset approaching it, which takes it away from sort of this having to have a huge amount of listeners or subscribers to the fact that you have absolutely highly targeted people that are interested in the sponsor's company or product or service, whatever it happens to be. So to me, that's where it's a huge thing that took me a long time to kind of get my head around, but it's the conversations I have with sponsors now almost don't have to do necessarily with what I have for listeners. It's how highly targeted they are and how exactly perfect of an ideal customer they are for that person. And then I take the conversation into, I want to create a partnership. So I want this to be long-term. This needs to work for both of us. That's the only way this is sort of successful, is if it does that. And sort of shaping the conversation around that. There's shows that, I mean, have 1,000 listeners or less and can get really good dollars on their sponsorship rates because of the fact that it's very, very, very targeted. So if you have a general news show, obviously you're not going to be nearly as targeted because kind of everybody can listen and your ad rates go down and therefore you need a million listeners to every episode. But when you start getting into even like business and entrepreneurship like me, and as I shared with my demographics, it's highly targeted people. So businesses that need to target those people are willing to pay more money than they would pay to like an NPR show or just a general sort of story-based show, because you kind of have to then pick through everybody that you weren't looking for. It's like, I've already done that hard work for you. And then it's, to me, that's just the way you have to think about it. Partnerships, and don't focus on your numbers, focus on sort of that interaction with your audience and how highly targeted they are and perfect they are for the customer. And that means that a show like me, I really shouldn't be going after like Casper mattresses or something, because yes, everybody sleeps in a bed, but that's the money and the sort of the return isn't there because it's not a business sort of to business transaction. And so you need to kind of think of it in that way. And so this is your first part of the question is, what are the best viable ways to monetize it? I'm only talking about sponsorships, partnerships, as I like to call them, and advertising. But then there's a whole nother world of the indirect sort of ways to monetize, which can be done. And Jared's probably better to speak on these things because he has done these with his show a lot more than I have, per se. But with sponsorships, don't get stuck on those numbers. Really get stuck on who they are exactly. And you need to find this out as the host and the creator of the show. You need to know who these people are. And you need to know who they are, sort of a perfect ideal customer for.
Yeah. And it's great if you can build the type of audience that can attract sponsorship, but, you know, especially for people who have Rainmaker and are able to harness Rainmaker's power for digital commerce, thinking about the indirect ways to monetize a podcast, I think, you know, they're really smart. And I think that could be a podcast that leads to an online course or a podcast that leads to an ebook, or maybe you create WordPress products. And so you're going to create a podcast that's helping people with WordPress. And oh, by the way, you have these different plugins that they can use and these different themes that they can use. And so again, your podcast itself may not directly make money. You may not get paid per episode, but if you're driving people to an online course like we do with the Showrunner or some type of community or some type of other digital product, now that podcast is helping you monetize. And so, you know, when you talk about the most viable ways to monetize it for, you know, the audience of people that are using Rainmaker, I really think that thinking about it from an indirect standpoint is a smart way to think about it. And let me then throw out two other ways that often get overlooked, and they're not going to make you rich probably, but they can help to kind of, you know, support you as you get going. And that is affiliate marketing and donations. You know, we at the Assembly Call, our last donation drive, we made, I got to get the exact number, but it was almost like $1.25 per email subscriber in donations, which was really, really good. I mean, it's not a huge audience, but that was, you know, really good money that did more, you know, it exceeded just what we needed to cover the costs. And that was a good sign, I think, that we'd built a strong connection with our audience. And, you know, if the content is free and so many more people now request donations it's not necessarily requesting donations, but open it up for support, because we had people asking to support us. And if you've built a long-term relationship with your audience, you can do that. And especially if you don't have other products to sell, donations are a great way to basically say, hey, you know, the podcast is the product right now. I want to keep doing this. I don't want to have to charge you, you know, but, you know, we need some help keeping this thing going. And that can really help with donations. And then also think about affiliate marketing. And affiliate marketing can be a good way also to do little mini tests with your audience to see what kind of products might work before you go all the way down the road of, you know, of building a product. And one thing to think about with affiliate marketing, if you're going to do it on a podcast, is you want to make the link something easy to remember, because not everybody's going to go to your show notes and click on your link. So what is something easy that people could remember? And I actually went through this offseason for the Assembly Call, and we have some affiliate relationships like with the official IU online store. And so, you know, and it was always real clunky to get people to go there. I created a redirect at, you know, assemblycall.com/IU store, which does work. But what works even better is iustore.shop. I bought that domain, did a redirect to it. And so if you're going to do affiliate marketing with a podcast, thinking about the absolute best domain that you can get for people to remember and to be able to, you know, put into their smartphone right there while they're listening is a good way to maximize that. And so I guess the point here is there are a lot of different ways to monetize. I think if you have Rainmaker, you want to think long and hard about the best ways to go indirect with it. You know, create products that you are using your podcast to promote and to build that long-term relationship. But then, you know, you can, you know, figure out maybe some of these other ways like donations or affiliate marketing or even sponsorship once you get to that point, you know, that can kind of help subsidize some of these costs for your podcast. But I think for most of the people listening to this, going indirect is going to be where the biggest potential is for you to really get the most bang for your buck with a podcast.
Man, that is some great information there. The whole time I'm thinking too, is that both of you, people can go to Showrunner, the showrunner.fm. And you've talked about this over and over, you know, individually in dedicated shows, but, it's something that comes up quite a bit. So, highly recommend, people check out the Showrunner for this too. Obviously there's only so much we can talk about in a couple of minutes here, but this is a really, really great topic. How about we do rapid fire on questions 10 and 11 and then see what time we got left and try to get in a few, a couple more. We'll see where we're at. But question 10, do you transcribe your shows? What are the pros and cons of nice rapid fire. Okay. On.
Well, I will say this,
and is there any substantial SEO benefit?
Yeah. So let me say, I don't transcribe any of my IU basketball shows because the content is time sensitive. It's not relevant a week later. Right. So there's no point in doing it. The Sites podcast, I do transcribe, but the main reason I transcribe it is because I work from a script when I'm recording. So I can basically take that script and turn it into a transcription. I don't know that we would necessarily pay for the transcription otherwise. And it's pretty easy to transcribe because I'm basing it on old blog posts. So in that sense, you know, the path to transcription, there aren't many roadblocks there. It's pretty simple. So it makes sense to do it. But I have never personally paid to transcribe any episodes we have at Rainmaker, you know, for some of our shows. And I think there can be an SEO benefit, but it's not something that I necessarily recommend.
Yeah, it's tough to do. It can be expensive, but, you know, if those things are not a problem for you, that SEO benefit is definitely there. I mean, you know, you think about it, you've got multiple thousands of words on a page in text along with your audio there, but it is not for the faint-hearted. That is definitely for sure.
Yeah.
Question 11 is, I think, a great way to end the official part of this. I love this question. When should a solopreneur, your typical Rainmaker customer, not start a podcast? Probably a lot of answers to this, but let's throw out a couple.
I mean, you know, I think it's interesting. The very first question that we got, where, you know, that questioner was really focused on the demographics and do my people listen to podcasts? And I think if you have an audience that is not into audio and you know that, then that would be a time to not start a podcast because, you know, you're not really going to get the return on your investment of time. So I would caution people about having a preconceived notion about whether your audience is not into podcasts. I would really test that assumption. But if you, for whatever reason, you know that they're not, then I wouldn't start a podcast and try to force that.
Yep. I'd throw a curveball in here too. Oh, Johnny, you got something? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think as a solopreneur, I think we all agree here, everybody listening and taking part in this, that content marketing is absolutely key. And I think in that you have to pick sort of which path you're going to take and go hard at it. So whether that's audio, video, or text. So if you are going hard into text or hard into video already, you absolutely should not start a podcast right now. You should focus, stay focused, keep your head down, keep working, because it will work if you are following the steps correctly. If you are at a standstill and don't know which path to take, then you need to kind of look inside and decide which one. And perhaps audio is the one for you. I didn't even know actually audio was the one for me. I didn't think it was, but I went for it anyways, and I really enjoyed it. And then I just went head down into that. So to me, if you are already pushing another direction, do not like split the two and go 50-50 into each, because you'll get nowhere. I honestly believe that you have to stay focused until you get traction in one, and then you can sort of start branching out. But to me, that's it. If you're already invested somewhere else, keep going there.
That is killer advice.
Great advice.
If I may piggyback on that, you know, there's a lot of talk about, I mean, not just talk, it's fact of course, the rise of podcasting, the proliferation of new shows coming out, however many there are every day, week, month. And there's no doubt this is true. There's no doubt that the competition in starting a new podcast today is much higher than it was even a couple of years ago, even a year ago. But the opportunity is that much higher as well if you do it right and if you hit it. But I will say this. Can't remember where it was, but heard some great advice a couple months ago. And this is in alignment with Johnny's comment. It's how about definitely, you know, if you're thinking about starting a podcast, go through the process, think about it. Are your people into it? What Jared said, are they audio people? But also think about this. Maybe based on your strengths and the audience that you're trying to get to, maybe it would be best to go into text, you know, original content, content curation, whatever it may be. But the flip side of there being so many podcasts out there is that it also gives you the opportunity, instead of doing your own, to be a guest on all of these podcasts, because so many are looking for really high quality guests to be on their show. And the idea of you going out and becoming someone who is reliable and interesting and valuable to be on a show, I mean, that is gold, you know, to a podcast producer. So that might be, you know, it's a little flips the script just a little bit for this whole point of this Q&A, but it might be better to approach it from, instead of doing your own show, become an expert, like awesome, interesting guest, and start making relationships with producers of podcasts out there as a way to drive traffic back to your own stuff. So it's just
good
a
point.
Thought.
Nice. I like that.
Brian Hayes, did we have, I think, I don't want to put you on the spot, man, but I think you said there were a couple of questions that we might have been able to get to. Jared and Johnny, do you have 2 minutes here, 3 minutes for rapid fire for a couple of questions?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay. And I wanted to address one thing that I saw in the questions. Oliver said, a good point regarding donations, Patreon could be used. Patreon certainly could be used. And I think a lot of people have had success with Patreon. I have looked into Patreon. I didn't use Patreon because I didn't want to pay. I think it was they take 5% off the top, and I didn't want to pay that. Now, I would have if I thought I was going to get some kind of benefit from the community, or that, you know, people would go to Patreon and search and they'd find the assembly call. But it's not really a place for sports. You know, it's more of a place for, you know, kind of artists and you know, different shows like that. That they do, you know, kind of have some built-in elements that help you do it. But Brian Hayes helped me get the, you know, some of the PayPal buttons up on my site. But because I was able to do that myself, it just didn't make sense to pay the 5%. And so I would, and I say this only to say, don't just assume Patreon is the default that you need to use. It is pretty simple to put PayPal buttons on your site and to do this yourself, and a little bit of time invested now can save you a whole lot of money later that isn't taken off the top of your donations. So it's just something to make sure that you look at before you just jump right into Patreon.
Great point. Brian, are you there? Were you able to get a couple questions or okay?
Yes, and this one comes from Brigitte. Excuse me if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. What are good drills, practices, or methods to control all the kind of fillers and how to train to be a more pronounced speaker so every word can be understood?
So on mic skills.
Yes.
It's a great question.
How do we get better at being on mic and not every other word being I mean, I still, all these years later, every other word I say is
I'll tell you, I think the best thing that you can do, and it's the hardest thing to do a lot of times, is just listen to yourself. And I hate listening to myself. I have this weird thing, like even when I've just produced an episode and I want to just do a test and listen to it, I'll listen to the opening part. But as soon as it gets time for my voice to come on, I will literally pause it and take it off because I don't want to hear my own voice. Like it's a weird thing. Yep. But when I do, and when I listen through, it's always educational because I hear certain points where I'll do a like, or you know is my big crutch that I've tried to get rid of. And so the awareness is really important. And then the commitment to improving it. And I think it's not just when you're podcasting, it's really something all throughout the day that you want to try and think about. But I've never been able to do it and do it well without intermittently listening to myself, listening to some episodes that I've done, reminding myself, oh yeah, I do this way too much. And then I'm much more aware of it in just my normal conversation. And by trying to improve those habits, then it comes through on the show. So that's the way that's worked for me. Robert or Johnny, I don't know if you guys have any more specific, you know, techniques or tips that I just said, you know, right there. See?
Yeah, right. I'll steal from you. I actually think it was Johnny who said, you just got to put your show out and do 100 episodes before anything starts being any good anyway. So yeah.
It really just takes doing it and just putting it out there. But having, like Jared said, like having that awareness that you have this quote unquote issue, which I could argue that it's not an issue because we all have it. But that awareness of it will, I think, push you to get better. And it's not going to get rid of it altogether ever. And it doesn't need to. We talked about how editing those things out completely makes it seem inhuman. So that therefore tells us that it is human to talk like this. And it's natural. And it actually makes our listeners more endeared towards you because you are a human being as well. So don't take it as a complete negative. Work to get better, sure, of course, by all means. But it's not like the end all be all of running a show.
Yep.
And I will for help in getting and encouragement, really. Somebody recently brought up, I'm a fan of Joe Rogan's podcast, whatever. One of the biggest, you know, whatever you think of him, he's one of the biggest podcasters on the planet. And somebody recently said, hey, you need a little encouragement. Go watch Joe Rogan's first episode. It's on YouTube before he made it, started extracting the audio for a podcast. Go watch the first episode of Joe Rogan's podcast on YouTube. You can just search that. And versus where he is now and the kinds of guests that he has now and the kinds of downloads and the kinds of revenue that he's doing now, you will not believe how far he's come. And there's all kinds of examples like that, but that's a pretty spectacular one.
Yep.
Brian, do we have one more before we close it out?
Yes, there is one more. And this question was asked by Peter. Which sources of intro, outro, or section change music would you recommend and why?
Oh, interesting.
For sources, like where to find them, I'm assuming. So yes. I just want to pipe in because there's a lot of places where you can buy them and stuff. My music that I use in my show still to this day, I found on freemusicarchive.org.